Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams, keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hello, Santa Barbara, and welcome to another episode of Community Alert, Not If, But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, simulcasting at newspress.com. Our number here today, 564-1290, 564-1290, 866-564-1290, if you're listening to us on the Internet. Defensible space inspections start on June 1st by Santa Barbara County Fire. If you're living up in the front country, in the backside of paradise, what have you, now's the time to get out and start doing your weed whacking and brush mitigation and clearing. That would include at least a minimum of 100-foot clearance around your house. If you're on a slope or area that is not flat, you might want to consider going up to as high as 300 feet. For further information on what the requirements are, contact the local fire agency for your jurisdiction or Santa Barbara County Fire Department, 681-5500, 681-5500, and they'll get you squared away. Also, they're promoting, again, Ready, Set, Go, with the emphasis on ready and go this year. We are going to have a fire season. That's what we're going to be talking about today with our guest, former California State Fire Marshal Chief Ronnie Coleman. Thank you, and welcome back to Community Alert.
I'm delighted to be here, Michael.
Well, we've talked on this show many times about a variety of things, and I thought this time would be fun to talk a little bit about what wildland firefighting was like back in the 60s and the 70s, and kind of what wanted me to walk down memory lane a little bit was the fact that fire camps this year are going to be significantly different. The response, initial attack, and extended attacks are going to be somewhat different. And in some cases, going back to the way things used to be. So I figured, let's talk a little bit about what that was about, and I couldn't think anyone more qualified than you.
Well, I've been around a while, and I just celebrated my 80th birthday last Sunday.
Yeah.
So I guess hopefully my memory works okay.
Well, it's certainly, I know that you and I have had many, many hundreds of miles of talking about these things, and perhaps we can share some of it today with the audience. What's the big difference, in your view, with wildland firefighting today, as it's done by CAL FIRE, and the way it was done back in the 1960s and the 70s, which was kind of the turning point for it, with CDF, or what was then called CDF?
Well, if you look back into the history of wildland firefighting in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, there was a real line of demarcation between municipal fire protection and wildland fire protection. The two entities didn't mix too much. As a matter of fact, my first couple of fires, I started in the Forest Service in 1960 and went on several Forest Service fires and never recall ever seeing a mutual aid engine or a large fire camp. We were not as mobilized in those days, and we were not as organized in those days as we are today. And the amount of resources committed to wildland fire has increased significantly from the 60s. The Bel Air Fire is one of the ones I remember in the early part of my career, and it was in L.A. City. And it was L.A. County, I can't remember exactly
LA
which
City,
one
yeah.
was the predominant one. But the fact is, things were a lot more primitive back in those days than they are today.
Well, they didn't have all the equipment and toys that we have today and resources. A lot of it was done the old-fashioned way, and that's kind of what I wanted to get on. I know I started down in Orange County myself, and one of the things that we liked when I was a reserve with the Sheriff's Department down there was when the brush fires started, one of the brush trucks would always be towing the barbecue pit. And we knew that people were going to be eating good if that was going out. And you would never do that today. I don't even think you can get a permit to do that today. But back then, CDF was very much self-contained, in many ways better than it is today, wouldn't you think?
Well, I would hesitate saying that.
Maybe differently is a better way to put it. Not betterly, but different.
I would classify CAL FIRE as of today is a tremendous increase in the amount of resources that have been devoted to wildland firefighting, And our master mutual aid system is probably the premier mutual aid system for the country. So what's beginning to happen, though, is no matter how many resources we have on the ground, unless fire prevention plays a role, fuel reduction plays a role, we don't stand a chance of stopping some of these fires. The reason is that people have continued to move into urban wildland areas without taking care of the brush and so forth. And the big problem is, no matter how many engines we have or strike teams we have, is often inadequate under bad weather conditions.
Well, to that regard, the governor just recently appointed $145 million for wildland CDF, or CAL FIRE, I should say, staffing, seasonal staffing this year. That's a substantial increase in funding for personnel.
That's huge.
For 200 or more seasonal firefighters, all of whom I'm sure are going to be quite busy if Santa Barbara's current grass fire dispatches are any indication of what we're going to be looking at in the future. We didn't have the communications back in the 60s and 70s that we have. Both radio and the PIO function was a lot different. That's changed a lot, hasn't it?
Well, the technology has changed, period. I was having a conversation recently with a bunch of young firefighters, and I mentioned a paper sleeping bag, and they said, "What's that?" Back in the 50s, we used to have to sleep on the fire line frequently in paper sleeping bags. Nowadays, we have much better accommodations, and we have showers on fires and things of that nature. Our communications technology is constantly being challenged to be able to expand to meet the need, and it's significantly better than it was in 1950.
Well, some of that's driven by the Fair Labor Standards Act and union contracts and OSHA and NIOSH and a whole litany of other agencies that the safety stuff, as well as the requirement that you be off of your work area, which is why so many people are transported down off the hill and then brought back up the next day. That's kind of frustrated things in some ways, hasn't it?
Well, I haven't been on a command structure on an ICS type of operation in over 20 years because of my career path took me into the fire marshal's office and so forth. So I spent most of my time looking at fire prevention activities. But I've talked to a lot of fire ground commanders, incident commanders, about what is going on and changing in their world. And I would have to admit that the ICS system, incident command system, has improved significantly the use of our resources on a statewide basis. And then match that up with improvements in firefighting foams and things of that nature. We continue to increase our arsenal, but we continue to have devastating fires.
Well, we're coming up to our first break here, and I wanted to get out that our sponsors, the California Fire Safe, California Fire Safe Council, Fire Services Training Institute, Wear and Prepare, all sponsoring the show, as well as our local Wear and Prepare group. And we'll be right back with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman on Community Alert on KZSB AM 1290. Well, welcome back to Community Alert, Not If, But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Simulcasting at newspress.com, visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman. We were talking last period about wildland firefighting, what it was like back in the 60s and the 70s, and kind of reminiscing a little bit about then as opposed to now. Ronnie, what was the big fire that woke you up on wildland firefighting that made you say you were totally into it, or you were second-guessing whether or not you wanted to stay in it?
It was being aware of the Bel Air fire. I wasn't on the Bel Air fire per se, but I was in the fire service at that particular time in the U.S. Forest Service. And the old saying goes, it was a predictable catastrophe. And it was a kind of an eye-opener. Then, as I worked in Orange County, California at that particular time, on the Cleveland National Forest. And over the period of, let's say, 62 through about 65, we had several more fires out in the Chibuco area and the Cleveland National Forest, and that kind of got whetted my appetite for being a firefighter.
Yeah, you kind of get it. What back then, how were the crews staffed up?
Actually, we had, I'm kind of recalling some of this from just my own personal experience, not necessarily everybody else's personal experience, but I was on an engine company in Chibuco Canyon, and we were staffed with three people. And there was a driver and two firefighters, and a foreman, I should say, and a firefighter. Really, the question was not so much what was on each individual company, but how many we could put together collectively. And it wasn't uncommon in those days to have fires that really taxed the local resources because there just weren't enough people to go around.
Well, back then, let's see, it would have been Black Star Canyon, Silverado Canyon, Majesca, Tribuco, all had volunteer fire departments. Holy Jim, that was another one back up in there. That's all changed today with the Orange County Fire Authority. When did Orange County in particular has always been kind of on the cutting edge, both with fire and law enforcement. When was the big shift when you started seeing things starting to modernize, more or less in the mid-70s?
Well, there was a considerable amount of change when Orange County actually left CAL FIRE. I can't remember the exact date, to be honest with you. My memory doesn't work that effective this morning. But they had been a contract with CAL FIRE for Orange County area, and the organization changed and become Orange County Fire Authority back in the 70s, 80s, and so forth. And that brought about a separation, but not necessarily a change in technology. The Orange County Fire Authority was a surrogate for the CAL FIRE, a wildland fire agency.
Well, all the way through up to the mid-70s, firefighters in a lot of these agencies, there was a second job for them. It's not like it is today. I know where I went to school, a lot of the kids, their dads were volunteer firemen, but they were also electricians and plumbers and worked at the gas station and the hardware store and the pharmacy and all of that kind of stuff, much more traditional. But that all started to fade away by mid to late 70s.
Well, the volunteer fire service has eroded significantly over the last 30 years. Numbers of people who volunteer or being willing to volunteer has decreased, especially out in certain areas where people are required to have all the training and so forth that is inherent in the fire service today. We can't find a large number of people who want to do it. And so the volunteers are less of a force than they once were. But I think if you look at the mutual aid system overall, and you talk to people like Kim Zagaris from OES, he definitely commented about the fact that volunteers are still a very active part of the firefighting operations in California.
Well, they're a central component in Northern California because they're the ones that are there. And I don't think people completely appreciate how rural portions of California really are. I remember there's parts of this state that it takes you a day. In fact, Tule Lake, you got to go into Oregon and come back into California just to get to the place. It's so remote. And Siskiyou County, those areas, Trinity County, you can spend a day just going from one place to another. And yet the volunteers are already there. But I know in Trinity County, things have gotten so desperate up there, especially now with the virus, that there's nothing going on. So that just further erodes the volunteer fire services all because they don't have the staffing. I'm not sure that's going to change, though. Do you?
No, California is still going to be two separate areas. Southern California and Northern California are almost like two different ends of the spectrum. I don't think there's any volunteer companies even left in Orange County. The last one disappeared a couple of years ago. But there are still fire departments up in Northern California that are entirely volunteer, including their chief. And the fact of the matter is, it's probably going to stay that way economically.
Well, it's become so expensive. When you're looking at fire stations being $1.5 million, $2 million in operating costs just for that alone, and then you look at volunteer fire departments, which are operating in $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, maybe even $50,000 if they're rich budgets, there's a huge difference in what it costs, primarily because of personnel, but there are other factors. What are the principal changes that you've seen in your career between the way it was in the 60s and 70s when you started and what we have available to us today?
The single most significant change I see is the role of ICS. Back in the early days, I remember my first couple of fires I went on and the kind of the chaos that we had of organizing and getting getting our forces aligned up in an effective way was kind of random, and a lot of it had to do with the experience level of the incident commander and so forth. ICS came along in the late 60s, early 70s, and really started having an impact on the way we fought fire. I think that ICS is the formula for command and control. It's probably the most significant.
What do you think was the driving force for the fire service, which was so rich in tradition, to actually go to that degree of structure and make things happen in an ICS format rather than just pure seniority like it had been done previously?
Well, I wasn't directly involved in the creation of ICS. I was an early recipient of it because I was down in Southern California and watched L.A. City, L.A. County, and Cal Fire and Forest Service starting to put that together. And I would say that the big difference in why the ICS became a reality was the leadership of some major fire departments who definitely saw that there was a need to improve effectiveness on the fire ground. The ICS was organized using some military principles. Guy named Bill Hanna was very involved in it at the time. And it was a leadership component out of those agencies that created that was called FireScope.
Right.
And FireScope still exists today. It's an organizational structure that looks after wildland fire specifically. Without that leadership, we probably still would have been doing a lot of things by the seat of our pants.
Well, I think in many ways, FireScope is the California Fire Service.
Well, there's no question in my mind it has a huge influence on the way we deploy and the way we maintain our forces, and has had a significant impact on the way we deploy on major fires.
You know, as we've been talking here, I've been looking for the Robert Conrad video, and I finally found it. It's not as easy to find as it used to be, but Robert Conrad, LAFD Bel Air Fire, you'll hit on it. C-SPAN has it in their archives. It's dated 1962, and it's a fascinating video as to, A, the fire in Bel Air, but and how they responded to it, but the chaos and what it was like trying to get people out of those Bel Air streets and back down onto Sunset and over towards the freeway, and how fast that fire ripped through that area, Bel Air being just above UCLA campus, that area there. It's quite a video. Again, it's called 1962 Documentary with Robert Conrad as the narrator, produced by the Los Angeles City Fire Department, who just had a catastrophic fire down off of 3rd Street this weekend. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit when we come back. Visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman on Community Alert. Ted's indisposed today. He'll be with us again next week. Simulcasting at newspress.com. You're listening to KZSB AM 1290. Welcome back to Community Alert, not if, but when, positive preparation for disasters. Simulcasting at newspress.com, sponsored in large part by the California Fire Safe Council. Visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman. We were talking during the break about this video. I finally found the one that I was actually looking for, which is it's the same one, different title, Designed for Disaster. And it's a 1962 production with William Conrad as the narrator. It's only 26 minutes long. It's in YouTube. That's an easier way to find it. And I would encourage folks to watch this. Granted, it's dated, but the reality is it could be the same exact scenario today. And Bel Air hasn't changed all that much. The same streets are still there. You weren't there at that, but you certainly learned from it, did you not?
Very definitely. It was kind of a what you call a study fire. That you would put it into some of your simulations and training scenarios and so forth. My personal belief is if you watch that documentary and then compare it to news broadcasts of contemporary fires, there's still a lot of similarities. We still have a lot of the same problems. When you combine weather, topography, and fire, you get the same outcome, no matter how many fire trucks you got. The fact of the matter is the number of people on a fire apparatus has an awful lot to do with initial attack as to whether you can get a jump on a fire. But once it reaches a certain level and you've got those three factors against you, it's Katie bar the door. And the technology that we're using today is still struggling to keep pace with the destruction we're seeing today.
You know, I think the Bel Air fire was for the fire service what the Norco shootout and the CHP shootout up at the truck scales were for law enforcement. Those were turning events that woke folks up to that the game was changing, getting more serious. The cops were outgunned. There were people out there willing to do a lot of things that they didn't think they would have done before. And in the case of fire, it was starting to get much more aggressive. And the needs for equipment, communications, ICS structuring, relief of personnel, that was all brought home with a vengeance with the Bel Air fire. We were talking during the break also about the fire they just had over the weekend down in Los Angeles with LAFD. Was that Station 9, I think it was, where the folks were up on the truck company was up on the roof and had to evacuate and escape. More importantly, were the guys that were inside the building that were called out by their astute captain. It points to experience. Some of the veteran guys that were there realized something was wrong and started taking action before something happened. We're starting to lose those kinds of guys, aren't we?
Well, there's kind of a natural phenomena occurring where there's a turnover in the experience level of our command personnel today. Based on hiring practices of 30 years ago. There was a surge in the 70s with the increase of the number of individuals who joined the fire service. Now they're all retiring out. And as a net result, we are having kind of an experience gap. It's not universal. It doesn't happen everywhere. But the fact of the matter is that we don't have that reservoir of 30, 40-year-old individuals who got a lot of firefighting experience. As a matter of fact, in the field of structure firefighting, municipal firefighting, I would submit that the emphasis on EMS over the last couple of years has altered the way that we accumulate experience. We don't have as strong a background in firefighting as we once had.
Well, I think that the hiring practices certainly have changed, and that's not all bad, for sure.
No, but not all bad. It's just different.
I see that in my world, what's happening, both in fire and law enforcement, corporate security, investigation world, all of them are doing the same thing. They're hiring back their retirees because mm-hmm. they have not properly prepared or have not been able to prepare. That might be a more fair way to say it, for the retirement of all these guys. And there are certain key individuals in the fire service that are holding the golden box, if you will, of how to get things done, who to call, how to make things happen, what all the back doors are, how to sidestep things that typically choke up a process. These guys are leaving. And I'm not sure what the solution is other than for us to appreciate that, you can't let that much talent just walk out the door with their flat badge and retirement card.
Well, I think it's a phenomenon that's occurred throughout the history of the paid fire service. When I first became a fireman in Costa Mesa, as a municipal fireman, I worked with guys who were World War II veterans and who had come to the job with a certain kind of experience about combat in general. And then that was replaced by a generation that came out of the Korean War. And then there was a generation that came out of the Vietnam War, et cetera. And all of these have accumulated in terms of building the experience level of people who are good at operating under stress. And it's now been 50 years in my particular career, and I've seen this wave of coming and going of experienced personnel about three times.
Well, some of the larger agencies, the chiefs, the police chiefs, fire chiefs, whatever, probably public works directors too, are not necessarily the ones doing the hiring. It's personnel. And that creates some interesting challenges, because how do you vet people that should and shouldn't be in some of these high-pressure jobs? Personnel is looking at one set of criteria, where the police chiefs, the fire chiefs, and the line supervision is looking for something entirely different. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a good debate to have, because the HR people feel very strongly about the selection process being fair and equally diverse and so forth, and they take exception to the fact that they're not the best qualified to select people.
Well, they're looking at it from what kind of skill set do you have to do this series of tasks. And on the surface, that may be a legitimate question to ask. But when you factor in stress and working conditions and the environment of the conditions that you're working in, that's a whole other story. I was watching some of the Edison guys up here working a couple weeks ago, and I was thinking there's so many similarities between these linemen and firefighters. They're using aircraft. They're in high and confined areas. They're up in the air. There's lots of safety issues. They're using heavy equipment, heavy vehicles. There's a fire risk with, obviously, not only that, there's the electrical risk. And these guys have definitely got to work together. And they also have the ability to get in and get out, just like the fire service does. I'm not sure we totally recognize there are other careers out there that are under the same kinds of stresses and pressures, and utility workers being one of them.
Yeah, right now the medical profession and the hospital staff, the nurses, medical technicians, and so forth are being characterized as America's newest heroes. And that would not have happened without the impact of a severe catastrophe such as the virus.
Yeah, you know, I was going to get all. We have a mutual friend at Mike Metro, Chief Metro from L.A. County. I was going to get a hold of him because the calls for medical service seem to have completely disappeared. Where normally the radio would be going all day long with medical aid calls, it's virtually non-existent. Where did all those calls for service go? Where did all the people that had to be tended to all the time, or at least they felt or thought they needed to be tended to all the time, where did they go? You know, there's been some interesting phenomena brought on by this virus that I think is worthy of some study and to look at. And how much of it is human nature? How much of it is redundancy because we do it every day? How much of it is this perceived need to have help with? Maybe you don't. You know, you were pre-911, as was I. Prior to 911, you got in the yellow pages to call an ambulance. And when they showed up, they had an embosser bolted to the door, and they wanted a credit card before you went anywhere. Those days are long, long gone. It's changed a lot.
Well, the same thing has happened to law enforcement. The news has been full of announcements about the fact that the crime rate has gone down, and mainly because homes are still occupied now.
I'm not sure the crime rate's gone down as much as people just aren't reporting crime.
Maybe.
Having people at home is definitely it. I do know there's no question that the traffic accident rate is going up per volume of vehicles, particularly with motorcycles and bicyclists. And I'm aware of several major bicycle crashes here in town that were involving high-speed vehicles and bicycles where they didn't belong. And the two never mixed well. I realize that everyone has their opinion about bikes and cars, but for the guy that's in the ICU on a respirator, it gets very real very fast. With that, we're going to take our next break, visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman on Community Alert. Ted on sabbatical today. He'll be back next week. Simulcasting at newspress.com on KZSBA Info Night. Welcome back to Community Alert, not if, but when, positive preparation for disaster. Simulcasting at newspress.com, sponsored by the California Fire Services Institute and the California Fire Safe Council and Aware and Prepare. I wanted to talk a little bit with you, Chief, about the National Fire Heritage Center. I know that they're just now getting into a new fundraising drive, and they've expanded some of their operations and some new folks coming onto the board. We've had some of their folks on as guests in the past. We've talked about them, but can you fill us in a little bit on what's going on with them?
Well, there's an old saying about people who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat the mistakes of the past. And about 20 years ago, the federal government did a study saying that one of the things that we were losing was the body of knowledge from the experienced people. And they created a concept called the National Fire Information Center, National Fire Heritage Center. And 10 years ago, that became a corporation, a reservoir of knowledge of the way things used to be, with a collection of tactics and strategy and fire extinguishing technology and so forth. And the Fire Heritage Center still exists today. We're collecting early works of the fire service, early works of individuals in the fire service who've contributed to the way we do business. For example, guys like Ralph J. Scott from L.A. City and Ed Bent from California, Leo Amabile, and people of that nature. It's housed back at the National Fire Academy, at least currently it is. And it provides a basis for study of the past.
Well, I'm at their new website, which is fireheritageusa.org. I'd encourage folks to take a look at it. One of the things that you've put up here that is intriguing that I wanted to talk about a little bit was the personal libraries. Having been there and seen the volume of books, you've got some great people here. Dennis O'Neill, Dr. O'Neill, we've had on as a guest with U.S. Fire Administration. His library is there. Your library is there. Many others. IFTA's library is also there. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, that's the purpose behind the library, is to have a body of knowledge that's researchable whenever we're looking at the past, present, and future of things. Everybody's got to remember that what is considered to be the changes that we've experienced in the last 50 years were led into by the experience of the previous 50 years. We don't use any steamers today to fight fire with, but steamers were a very high-tech solution in the 1880s in the fire service. And so the National Fire Heritage Center is a repository of those stories and those activities. One other name should be mentioned is Wayne Powell. Wayne Powell was the executive director of the area for over 10 years and was instrumental in collecting a lot of the personal libraries that are available through the Heritage Center.
He's a walking encyclopedia of information. We've had him on the show a couple times also. If there's anybody that knows on instant recall something, it's Wayne.
Yep.
I went from Emmitsburg all the way back to the airport, an hour and a half, and he never stopped talking. He gave us a tour from Emmitsburg all the way back to the airport. He knew every building. He knew the history. He knew the Civil War information. It was an amazing trip. So, but anyway.
Well, it gets to the basic issue. Why do we need to study the past? It's because the past is prologue to the future. If you look at it seriously enough, you can find the remnants of the people who influenced the fire service, who started off experimenting with new ways of doing things. For example, a history of the snorkel when it was introduced by the Chicago Fire Department, and things of that nature. The past is always the prologue to the future.
As I'm going through the website, it pops up on a photograph of sprinkler heads, and I was in a conversation just the other day about structural fire suppression sprinklers, and that they go all the way back to the 1800s. That's one of your pride and joys, is the sprinkler collection back there.
Yes, it certainly is. I'm a very strong residential sprinkler advocate, especially. And my personal belief is that kind of technology is going to help us solve the fire problem.
Well, it's certainly not going to hurt. And I'm curious as to, when you look at sprinklers and you look at the use of foam agents, they were both actively used in the early 1900s, and then they just sort of went away for a while. But they're back with a vengeance now.
Well, it takes years and years to be an overnight success, you know.
You were talking about the steamers in the 1800s. The fire steamers almost outlived steam locomotives. In fact, the steamer that Dave Hubert has came from the California Railroad Museum, the boiler.
The Railroad Museum.
So, it's fascinating. Steam was slow to go, but it was reliable. It worked. I'm wondering sometimes if it isn't going to come back.
Well, you never can tell how technology is going to evolve. I submit to you right now that the fire truck that we have on the streets today is a significantly different piece of fire apparatus than it was 50 years ago. It's more technologically intensive, which means that it can break down under bad circumstances sometimes.
Oh, it can break down. You don't even know what it is that's broken. So,
That's right.
I see Alan Brunicini's photo in here. He's another historical guy that he's not with us anymore, but there was a guy that was always talking about, what would the public say? What's Mrs. Smith going to do? I remember one of his comments was, no one's going to remember the fire truck, but they will remember what you said, did, and the service you provided.
There's a lot of experience to prove that people develop their perceptions of the fire service from a singular incident that occurs to them personally.
Correct. So, well, we're going to take our next break, give us a little bit extra time on our last segment. We'll be back in just a minute. That website again, fireheritageusa.org. That's fireheritageusa.org. And we'll be right back with Chief Coleman for closing thoughts on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, KZSB, AM 1290. Now, welcome back to Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman. Reminder, defensible space inspections start next month, June 1st, throughout Santa Barbara County. Further information, give the county fire department or the fire department for your immediate jurisdiction to call Santa Barbara County, 681-5500, and they can fix you up. Also, they've got a brochure going out throughout the county. Wildfire is coming. Are you ready? Extreme drought conditions have increased wildfire danger. Valuable tips inside for your home to withstand wildfire. That should be coming to your mailbox, if not already, soon. Chief, one last comment I thought we'd talk about real quick, and that's to promote all your writings. Everything you've written from 1961 forward for many of the various magazines available at CAFSTI.org under Table Talk with Ronnie Coleman. You started writing way back in, 61, 1960? It was a long time ago.
Early 60s. My first article was about a fire explorer post, and I was encouraged to write it by a guy named Jim Casey, who was the editor of Fire Engineering Magazine.
So that article is up there, along with a whole bunch of other sprinkler age in particular, were the ones that I liked. Also, we did some tabletop interviews, interviewed folks from throughout California in fire stations. Production was actually in the fire station, so there's lots of background noise and whatever. Many of them were done here in Santa Barbara, thanks to Chief Dyer with Santa Barbara County Fire. We did them there, but we got around. Which was your favorite interview that we did? We had a lot of historical figures that aren't with us anymore back when we did those.
I kind of treasure the ones that involve people that are no longer with us, because that's what history is all about, is what you think about the contributions of people who preceded you. And, you know, at my age of 80, I'm kind of looking down about how much longer I'm going to be able to participate in this process, and hopefully some of my articles will be useful to students of the future. I had a lot of favorites. One of my favorite, of course, was Tom Forrester, who is from up in Plumas.
Yeah, Tom was a fascinating guy. We never had him on the show. He wouldn't come on, but he was a huge asset to the Northern California Fire Service, and was also at Skywalker Ranch. He was the fire chief there also. So,
yes.
Fascinating guy, he and his wife both. So, but anyway, those magazine articles formatted into the table talk or the chief's file cabinet, and those are all available at CAFSTI.org under Ronnie Coleman. Well, Chief, we just have a couple quick minutes here. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share with folks before we go to the news?
No, I'm not sure I've got the right thing to say to bring a closure to this conversation, other than the fact that it's been a very, very interesting life journey to be involved in the fire service and see all these changes, bear witness to some of these changes, and to participate in some of these changes. I appreciate having the chance to talk about them on the radio show here, and hopefully there's somebody out there who is dedicated himself or herself to doing the same sort of thing that I've done over my career, and that's to write about it.
Write about it, share it with others, mentoring. We didn't get into that today. I know you're a big advocate of mentoring, and I know that you have hundreds of people throughout the United States that owe their careers to your mentoring in the past. Well, with that,
well, I've got a lot of phone numbers in my phone dial.
Well, what's the one thing you could pass on to the new young firefighter out there listening to this? What's the one thing you would pass on as the senior veteran who's been there, done that?
That's an interesting question. I would submit that probably the one thing is pay attention to what you're learning from your experience and pass it on.
Yeah. Well, and that showed in L.A. City this weekend at that vape shop. It was experience, and it got things going, and people said, wait a minute, we got to get out of here. And if anyone hasn't had a chance to see the videos, take some time to look at that, because that's what this job can really be about. And it happens in an instant. And what looks like a normal, just routine call suddenly becomes a life-threatening career builder for you. I don't know. There's so much to talk about with that particular fire. That must have shocked you when you saw it.
In fact, I received lots of input from my friends out in the field the following day. My email was full of comments about it.
Oh, I imagine it blew up with everybody wanting to know, what do you think, what do you think? Because I don't think everyone thinks those kinds of fires happen anymore.
They happen less frequently, but more intensely.
There's the hotel fire. You and I have driven by it, and I'm drawing a blank on the town that it's in. It's that brick hotel. It's a catacorner to the gas station we always stopped in. It's still
exactly
boarded up to this day.
It's Marysville, isn't it?
Marysville, that's it. Yeah, that hotel is still boarded up. No one's ever redone it. That's
where the fire chief got sued for not enforcing the code.
Yeah, and we see that reoccurring over time, where building inspections, fire inspections, code enforcement, that kind of stuff tends to take a back burner along with training, and then all of a sudden those two things become the forefront of what's saving guys' lives. So yep. I don't know. In any event, well, Chief, thank you very much for taking time out to be with us today. I very much appreciate it. I know that you love to talk about historical things. We could talk about this all day long. I particularly like talking about the colonial stuff. For those of you that like colonial, go to the wildlandresidents.org website. You can look up some of our past interviews. With that, we got to go. The news is next. This has been Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. We'll see you next week on KZSB AM 1290.
Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, with funding from the California Fire Safe Council, Grant 18 SFA SMG, Aware and Prepare, and the Fire Services Training Institute. Technical assistance is provided by Jim Williams and Richard Dugan. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and should not be interpreted as necessarily representing the opinions or policies of this station or sponsors. For further information, please call 805-964-7194 or visit wildlandresidents.org. Commercial use of this program is prohibited.